Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court pronounced today are posted in the clerk's office. There are three causes set for oral submission this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Sesco Production Company and Others versus Apex Pipe and Supply Incorporated and Others from Rusk County. J.R. Adams, doing business as Adams Oil Company and Others versus Petrade International Incorporated and Others from Harrods County. And Gunnar Nelson versus Phyllis Neal from Bowie County. In each of these causes, the petitioners will be given 25 minutes for oral argument and 10 minutes for rebuttal, and the respondents will be given 25 minutes for oral argument. Counsel in the second and third causes are not required to be in the courtroom while the causes preceding you are being submitted, but we would ask that you remain nearby so that we can move to your matter without delay in the event an oral argument ahead of you finishes early. Counsel in all three causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make applications with our clerk's office. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in the cause of Sesco Production Company and Others versus Apex Pipe and Supply.
May I please report, Mr. Ron Atkinson and Mr. Rex Nichols present arguments to the petitioners. Mr. Atkinson, will move.
Please court, Your Honor. Please court, I have 12 and a half minutes to speak to you since Mr. Nichols and I are splitting our time, although we are somewhat antagonistic to each other. First of all, I want to show the court the factual basis for this case. This is a case where a production company placed an order for pipe and was invoiced for a particular standard of grade of pipe, which is 2 7/8 OD EUEN80 seamless monogram Lone Star steel pipe. What makes that important is the testimony of the Lone Star steel executive who testified in this trial that Lone Star disc flat doesn't make seamless pipe. So that the invoice that started this chain of events to my client is a lie. There is no such thing as Lone Star seamless pipe. There never has been, and an invoice that purported to sell us that particular standard of grade pipe was a falsehood to begin with. Where that impinged is, the pipe was put in a hole, and those API standards mean that that pipe will withstand a particular pressure down hole. That's why you buy a particular standard of pipe. We ran the pipe in the hole, and through Halliburton and the other well logging companies, it was undisputed in the Court of Appeals in their opinion that the minimum specifications for crush pressure on this pipe were never exceeded. And yet after an acidizing operation, when the pipe was removed from the hole, it was collapsed. Therefore, the theory is pretty clear. If you sell me a piece of pipe and stamp it and monogram it, and warrants me that it will withstand a particular pressure down hole, and I can prove that I never put that much pressure on that pipe, and it collapses, then you breached your warranty to me. And that's what the jury found. The jury found that the pipe was merciful, that it wasn't fit for its particular uses, and that collapse with acid in the hole ran back in the formation, sealed off the formation, and we lost the entire hole. Now remember in this case that the Court of Appeals first attempted to reverse this case on sufficiency of the evidence. But on rehearing, when faced with the record of the case, that opinion was withdrawn, so the sufficiency of the evidence is no longer an issue. Going back to the case, after 37 months in the appellate court, the Tyler court decided, well, we can't reverse it on sufficiency of the evidence, but we will say that you submitted the wrong measure of damage. Now, that's hard to do in a breach of warranty case. If you read the Texas Business and Commerce Code that says that the remedies to be applied in breach of warranty cases are to be liberally construed, that's real hard to do. If you read the intent and you read the clear letter of the law in the Commerce Code, you almost can't have a wrong measure of damage in that statutory scheme. But more importantly than that, if you look at the petition in which this case was tried, there was only one allegation of the measure of damage, and that was loss of production. There was no special exception made to that. And under the Texas rule since 1941, if I plead a measure of damage I'm otherwise not entitled to and you fail to accept to it, you waive it.
What rule are you citing to?
60. Also, the most recent case on that was Judge Spear's very able opinion in 1982 of Murray versus O&A Express, which is found at 630 Southwest 2nd, 633. And you'll recall in that case we had the same situation. What happened in this case was the only thing I pled was loss of production. I didn't plead diminution in value before, value after. There was no special exception made to it. I put on one witness on damages, the only man who testified on damages, and the only testimony that he gave was loss of production. He never once said value before, value after. There was no objection at the evidence stage. Now, wait a minute, that's irrelevant. The loss of production is irrelevant, Your Honor. He's got to prove value before, value after. That was never done. So it was waived the second time. Then there were motions for instructed or directed verdict made, and that point wasn't raised in any of those. So we send the witnesses home, we're back in the charge session, and all of a sudden stand up and say, wait a minute, Your Honor, I object to submitting loss of production. The proper measure of damage is value before and value after. Well, it's been waived twice under the rule and three times by implication. And that's exactly what Justice Speer said in Murray v. O&A Express in 1982. That's what commentators have been saying since 1941. That's what the cases cited in my brief have said. If you let me plead it, and you don't specially accept to it, you waive it. Because the cases say, Tennessee Gas Transmission Company versus Moorhead has said, if you plead it, and if you introduce proof of it, and there's no objection to either, then you're entitled to have an issue submitted on it.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding what rule you're citing for.
Just a second, Your Honor. Rules 90 and 91. Now, let's look at the legal context of it. You sit there during the whole trial, you let the pleading sit on file for more than a year with no special exception, loss of production, no pleading of diminution in value. You go to trial, you don't object to the evidence. You don't put in your motion for instructed or directed verdict. You raise it for the first time in the charge session, and then only collaterally. But look at the practical effect of it. Well, George Templeman, by the way, the Court of Appeals opinion continually refers to the man as George Turner. His name is George Temple. It should not have been hard to have gotten straight. He was the only expert to testify in the whole trial. But George Temple testified that because of the failure of this pipe and the running of the acid back in the hole, these people lost production. And he gave the MCF reserves of the well, known as estimates, and he gave a range of pricing that you could expect for the loss of those reserves. And so then he testified, if you take the bottom scale of both of those, it's this amount. If you take the top scale of both of those, it's this amount. The jury went back to the jury room and they found $1,880,000 for loss for Cotton Valley Well. That is not out of line.
Well, when you say loss of production, do you mean the loss of the ability to produce out of the formation from any location on the lease?
Yes, sir.
So your contention is that the acid running back into the formation made it impossible to drill another hole?
Yes,
sir. Why isn't that a permanent injury to land?
Well, the point is, I think, in the procedural posture of this case, why wasn't that accepted to, or why wasn't there an issue requested on permanent versus temporary damage to land in conjunction with the objection?
If there had been such a point raised, do you agree that the proper measure of damages is the difference in market value and as a result of the damage?
If you ever reach that point, but procedurally you never reach it.
So your position rests on waiver. If the case were tried over a proper objection, in your view, as to the measure of damages, the measure should be the difference in market value.
Not necessarily because of Texas Business Commerce Code, which specifically says that remedies of this section shall be construed and shall be applied so as to obtain the most appropriate relief available for the consumer.
But wouldn't the proof be the same?
The proof's the same. What the Court of Appeals has reversed this case for is because the jury wrote down the answer and didn't put the math down.
Why, if the proof is the same, why did you object to this kind of issue being submitted? I mean, why not let the trial judge submit both ways and spare us the pleasure of being here?
I didn't object to the issue being submitted, Your Honor.
Well, they objected.
They objected to the issue, but the proof had been closed. The proof had been closed. The witnesses had gone home, and all the proof that the jury heard was not in terms of diminution of value, bay before, bay after. All the jury had heard at that point was loss of production.
Well, then I guess that's why, because you said a minute ago the proof was the same, so that's what I was...
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm...
Damages to property, the only damage to this property would be loss of production, would it?
That's right. The only damage to my client is loss of production. When I say the proof would be the same, I mean that you would say we have so many MCF or BCF of gas that we sell at this price before, and the only thing missing is it didn't say before this happened. Now we still have it, but we can't get it, so its value after that would be zero. The numbers are not going to change if you mean the proof.
Don't you have to take into account the expenses of production?
I believe that's an issue for the defendant to prove because it's in mitigation that day.
The expenses of production are in mitigation of damages?
Well,
how are you going to get it out of the hole if it don't incur some cost?
In this case, that was factored in Mr. Temple's testimony, which the pages of the statement of facts cited in the brief. We went and put it in. I don't think you can theoretically assume we produced it for free, but that's already covered in the same proof that's already in the record of this case. So now our point then becomes, why? If it's the same MCF with the same pricing scheme at the time, and if all you wanted to see was if the jury could add and subtract correctly, why reverse the case? There wasn't a single expert called on damages by the defendants at trial. They did not dispute the damage issues. That was never an issue until the charge, and after it had been waived twice by failing to accept and failing to object to the evidence. And what makes it so glaring is that it was the only evidence. That is the only way the evidence was coached. There wasn't any evidence that was introduced to say, well, what was the value before, value after? It was purely from the beginning, simply loss of production. So there's no way that the defendants at the trial court level could have missed the fact that this is the theory we're trying damages on. And this court has said since 1941, well, actually 43 would have been the first case it reached it, that if you don't accept to it, and if you don't object to the evidence, that's the theory you're going to try the case on. If you recognize the adversarial system, and you recognize the fact that once it's waived, it leaves the case and no one has to worry about it anymore, then the judgment of the Court of Appeals has got to be reversed, and you have to render judgment in this case in favor of my client against Apex Pipe and Supply. If the jury had written... Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm pleased to be here with a writ granted because, and I hope it's because it's the first time I've had an opportunity to have my points of error considered. It seems a little out of order, but basically I want to be sure the court's aware that Mr. Atkinson's client did not sue my client Mustang. I think the record probably clearly reflects that Mr. Atkinson's client ordered pipe from Atex. Atex was unable to fill the order. They ordered it from Crescent, who was likewise unable to fill the order. Crescent ordered it from Mustang, who was my client. The pipe was then picked up in Oklahoma City by ATEX. Crescent actually never took possession of the pipe. My complaint, Your Honors, is of course that without any evidence whatsoever, the trial court saw fit to grant indemnity against my client, even though there was absolutely no proof of any defect in this pipe at the time it left possession of my client.
Well, the jury found in special issue number 6 that the pipe reached Sesco without substantial change from the time it was originally sold.
I think if you will look back, though, you will find that that's conditioned on a prior issue which asked the question of what condition was it in when Sesco bought it from ATEX. As we were not a party to the suit, obviously the inquiry and the charge couldn't have been about the condition of the pipe as it came from us. There was no evidence whatsoever.
You were not a party in the suit?
No, sir. I was not a party to this suit.
How did they render a judgment against you if you're not a party to the suit?
Well, I was not sued by the plaintiff, Your Honor. Suit was brought against me for indemnity by Crescent and ATEX. And that's the exact point that I would like to make. This court has rendered an opinion in the case, the Plastex case, which we pointed out that we believe is very determinative of our position in this case. And what you've said is that under either theory, strict liability or implied warranty of merchantability, it's absolutely essential that there be proof of a defect at the time it leaves the hands of the one sought to be held liable. It is true, and the court correctly states, that this defect can be proved by circumstantial evidence. Mr. Atkinson's case in this instance is purely a circumstantial evidence case. The court does also discern, though, that where the proof of defect is attempted to be made by circumstantial evidence, it's absolutely essential that the plaintiff offer evidence that there was no mishandling or that he used the product properly. This record, as you will see, is totally devoid of any evidence as to what took place after the plaintiff got control of the pipe. In fact, the testimony is quite clear that it had been placed on pipe racks. It had been handled 3 or 4 different times by different people. It had been in and out of the well, and it was only some 30 days after production had begun in the well that the collapsed joint was noticed. As the court probably knows, there's many ways. The tongs can cause an injury to the pipe, it can be out of ram. There are many things that can cause the pipe to be defective. It's most important to note that all of the experts who testified in this case testified that, having been tested metallurgically, there was no defect in the pipe and that it in fact met the specifications. I would also like to point out to the court, for whatever it's worth, that even though Mr. Atkinson's client specified Lone Star seamless pipe as a part of his order, that specification was never made known to my client. In other words, all they did was order this same grade pipe without any specification of Lone Star seamless. I would also point out, too, of course, under the sales provisions of the Business and Commerce Code, it would have been extremely obvious to Mr. Atkinson's client that this was not seamless pipe. Nevertheless, there was never any real proof of any defect, a manufacturing defect in this pipe. And in the absence of that proof, it should be assumed that it was caused by some form of mishandling. As this court says in Plastex, and I think this is most important, for Crescent and ATEX to be entitled to indemnity against my client, I must have liability to the plaintiff. The plaintiff did not sue me. I was not liable to the plaintiff. And the court says very clearly, there is no right of indemnity against a defendant who is not liable to the plaintiff. In this case, Your Honors, it's my position that ATEX and Crescent had a duty, if they were to seek indemnity, to do one of two things. If under the warranty theory, they absolutely had to show that there was a defect. I would also point out to the court that we've gone a long way in connection with these indemnity cases, and the Business and Commerce Code does not give a right of indemnity. It's my understanding that all vestiges of common law indemnity have now been destroyed by this court, except those cases of pure vicarious liability and in certain contractual indemnity cases. The distinction should be made here so that you will not be misled as to Plastex. Although the court talks of the case in terms of being an implied warranty of merchantability case, the question of indemnity arose because there was also a pleading bringing the Deceptive Trade Practice Act into play. And of course, as the court's well aware, the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, after its amendment in 1977, did provide for indemnity. There is no such provision under the implied warranty of merchantability theory. If you look at the theory, the other theory, which is the strict products liability theory, it was incumbent upon these people not only to prove a defect in the pipe at the time it left our hands, but it was their duty to prove that they were a mere innocent retailer in the chain and that they did nothing that could have caused damage to the pipe while it was in their possession and control. Again, no evidence whatsoever was offered as to the handling of the pipe, the careful handling of the pipe, anything that would entitle them to indemnity. It's quite clear the trial court simply granted an instructed verdict against my client for indemnity for no other reason than we sold the pipe. It's just that clear.
Well, you can see that it's not Lone Star Cement.
I could see that?
No, I said you can see that.
Judge, nobody really knows what it was because when the pipe got inspected, strangely, both ends where the monograms would appear had been cut off. But I think the evidence will make it clear that it was not Lone Star Seamless because Lone Star didn't make a seamless pipe. So I would certainly concede that. But I do, with the court's questioning of that, I want to make it clear that the specs when it was ordered for me didn't say anything about it being Lone Star Seamless. Now, if ATEX may have had a duty to furnish Lone Star Seamless to the plaintiff, but when they order it from me, it's just say N80 blank, 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 then I'm not bound by that specification. And in fact, I have no knowledge that that's what the specification was from the plaintiff to ATEX. They just called on us to get some pipe, and we sold them the pipe. I would like to point out that even though we raised these points of error, this is the first time we've ever been heard. The Court of Appeals refused to even address the indemnity question in this case. And it's our position, whether the case is remanded for a new trial or whatever it's done with, there is no evidence that entitles these people to indemnity from us, and that this court's judgment should be that neither of the parties, having failed to adduce any evidence to support this directed verdict, that there be no indemnity from us. In other words, we should not be a party to this case in the future. They had their shot at us. They had their chance to prove, if they could, that there was a defect in the pipe at the time we sold it, and they failed to do it. And accordingly, Your Honor, we suggest that this court should enter judgment in this case, dismissing us and finding as a matter of law there is no indemnity under the facts and circumstances of this case. Obviously, I have no quarrel with Mr. Atkinson's side of this case because he didn't make me a party to the suit. I guess any defendant always feels better if the plaintiff doesn't recover than he he doesn't suffer any chance of losing. I think that when you review this record, and I think you'll hear argument on it, I don't know whether there was ever any proof of defect, but certainly there was no proof of any defect at the time it left the hands of my client. And therefore, indemnity in this situation simply doesn't exist as a matter of law. And all the court has to do is follow its own opinion in Plastex. Thank
perhaps,
you for your time.
Perhaps you can help me on this. Why, under the Court of Appeals ruling, finding that the case was improperly submitted, did they send the case back for remand? Your part as well as the other. I mean, why any of it back? And then if any one,
you know, one can only assume, Judge, because they didn't tell me anything. The court's first opinion goes off, as I see it, and says, in essence, we don't think the plaintiff proved any defect. That's what it goes off on. Then on rehearing, as Mr. Atkinson says, they came back and said, well, we think it was an improper measure of damages. Well, I happen to agree with them on both points, but that's neither here nor there. But insofar as why they wouldn't say, hey, they haven't proved any case against you, and as a matter of law, they're not entitled to indemnity and discharge me, I don't know. I guess they sat on this case an awfully long time before they did anything with it, and it appears there certainly was some confusion as to what they really wanted to do with it. That's the only answer I can give you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Okay, please report, Mr. Charles Clark. Mr. John Smith,
with
the arguments
from the
respondent. Mr. Clark, welcome.
Hey, please, Court. Atex Piping Supply, just to clear up the record, is a pipe broker in El Dorado, Arkansas. The facts in this case are undisputed that an order was placed, and it's kind of interesting that the appellant's attorney talks about the lie of the invoice. Well, they ordered the lie because they asked for something that didn't exist. And my client up in Arkansas, I guess, tried to fit it. They asked for seamless Lone Star pipe. It developed there is no such thing.
Well, why don't you tell them? We don't make this such a pipe. Well, you want something else?
I assume my client being up in Arkansas didn't realize that Lone Star's plant down in Dangerfield didn't make such pipe, but that's what really developed. But as it developed, the only testimony in the case from experts is that the pipe they got, welded pipe, is better pipe than seamless pipe. And there's no dispute about that. So there wasn't anything anybody got hurt by not having seen this pipe. The big issue's been made about that, but the only evidence is that they got better pipe than they bargained for. But in spite of that, Atex...
they got better pipe. Why did they why did the jury find a defect? They were not marketable.
I never have been able to answer why juries have done things, but the evidence in this case on defect is practically, in my opinion, non-existent. There were three people examining this pipe, three metallurgists, and nobody's ever found anything wrong with it yet. And that's, of course, Civil Appeals first time, that's what they wrote on. But the facts are that Atex ordered pipe from Crescent. They didn't have the pipe to supply the order. They ordered from Mustang. Mustang signed a stipulation in this case that was admitted into evidence that the pipe was the origination of the shipment was at Turner Brothers Trucking Company up in Oklahoma. It was shipped by a common carrier, not by Atex. The only thing Atex did was pay the bill. And it left Turner Brothers and was delivered to the appellant's possession in Kilgore, Texas. And they stipulated that it was in the possession of Mustang that entire time. So Atex never touched the pipe. And I don't think there's anything in the record to the contrary. And the trial court, when the plaintiff rested, found as a matter of law that Atex and Crescent were innocent retailers. And I guess to say retailer and the wholesaler. No doubt that Atex made the sale, a paper sale. But it did not furnish the pipe, and it never touched the pipe. So that is that's where we stand. Atex is sued, and Atex files a lawsuit against Crescent, its upstream suppliers, and against Mustang, asking for complete indemnity. And the trial court found, in effect, that there was no evidence, but that the last party, as far as the parties before the case having possession of the pipe, was Mustang Production Company. And the jury found that when it left, impliedly, it said when it was, said it, did it reach Cesco without substantial change from the time it originally sold, and they found that it did. So I submit to the court that the law of this state has always been that a that an innocent retailer, which ATEX is in this case, should have complete indemnity against the parties that furnish the pipe and furnish the product, and in this case it happened to be Oil Field Pipe. Now, I do want to address very briefly the correct measure of damages. And I think the Court of Civil Appeals correctly held that the issue submitted was not proper. I dispute the fact that the proof would be the same. Statement made a moment ago, well, we had an engineer that said, well, here are the reserves. And basically, if you read his testimony, he said, well, I think there's so much gas in the ground because of one test that was made when this well was first came up, was first completed. He said, based on that, the standard price for gas is this, and it's going to last this long, and that's what they've lost. That is not the same as someone coming into court who said, yes, I've got that data, and a willing buyer would pay X number of dollars for that well, because that willing buyer would probably take into consideration production history of Cotton Valley wells, how they often come on strong and decline very rapidly. And I don't think there's any testimony that anyone could say approached the market approach, and that is what a willing buyer would give, what a willing seller would take for that well. And certainly the engineering testimony that was given does not come close to that. I don't think you'd find many oil people say, well, I'll let an engineer give me a report. When he says what he thinks it's going to produce, I'll multiply that time what the price may be, and that's what I'll pay for it. There was no evidence of that. There's no evidence that this reservoir 600 acres unit was permanently damaged. That defies human imagination that you pump enough acid in the ground to damage 600 acres of formation. No such evidence right. In this case.
I thought that's what the... There's only one expert on that. I mean, you were fighting it mainly on liability, it sounds to me. Like.
Yes.
And there was only one expert, this Temple or Turner, whoever it was, who even mentioned damages, right?
Yes.
And he said that these were lost... His estimate was that this was lost production that never would be recovered anywhere else. Isn't that what he said?
I don't think he really said that if you read his testimony. I think he said this well has been damaged and it's not going to produce again. I don't think he said you can't drill a well on 600 acres.
Well, if there's any evidence he said that, then our hands are tied.
Well, if there's any evidence he said that, I still think proper measure damage was not used.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, your brief never mentioned breach of warranty, but that is what they sued under, right?
Yes.
And there you're not limited to land damages, as it were. It's not like there's a trespass on land
yes.
or something. There are broader measures you can choose from, are there not?
Yes, there are, sir.
And why would this measure be unacceptable under a breach of warranty theory, as the damage caused by the breach of warranty? That is, so much gas lost.
Well, it could be, but I think if the record is carefully studied in this case, what you're basically going to find is that the engineer basically said this well bore and the area surrounding it has been damaged. It's not going to produce again. I think the correct measure of damage in this case is obviously the cost of drilling and completing a new well.
Why didn't you object to the testimony that came
I'm not sure we did. Now, I know counsel has said there was no objection made during the trial, and frankly, I have not reread the record well enough to tell you that no objection was made. I think objection was made as to the speculative nature
of the testimony. That's what you should be pointing out.
But it may well be that it was not objected to. But I do know that we did object to the charge as submitted by the court, and I think the court has an obligation, trial court, to submit a proper measure of damage to an issue that properly submits proper measure of damage to the jury. And in this case, I don't think it did.
Well, assuming you haven't specifically objected to it in an effective manner, haven't you waived it?
Your Honor, I think you, when you object to it at the time the charge is submitted, that's the first time you really know what the plaintiff's going to submit to the jury.
Counsel, hold on. How about the pleading stage? You know, they pled loss of production. You did
true.
Not specially accept, and you may not have objected to the evidence that came in.
Well, of course, the evidence that came in, we had no idea what he was going to submit in the way of an issue at that time.
Well, he put you on notice. He said, we're going to submit loss of production. That's what he planned.
Yes, sir.
Well, why have you not waived any objection?
Well, I think the standing alone, I think that we've cited authority. McDonald's cites cases that say a court has an independent obligation to submit a proper measure of damage to a jury. And that's the position we take on it. We did not waive it.
You're saying that you could have not objected to the charge at all and still won on appeal?
No, sir. I think we've got to object to the charge.
And up to that point, they can plead the wrong damages and prove the wrong damages, and that's their tough luck.
Well, I think a plaintiff has an obligation to come in and choose a measure of damage that the law recognizes and to submit evidence along those lines and submit an issue along those lines. I don't think the defendant has tried his case for him. And that's more or less what we'd have to be doing in this case. Your Honor, if you've got no further questions, that's all comments I have.
Anything further? Thank you,
counsel. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. John Smith will present further arguments to the respondents.
May it please Your Honor, it's a pleasure to appear before Your Honor once again. I'd just like to address one thing about the reason behind the cases. We're talking about permanent and temporary damage. What is implied warranty? Or strict liability and as it relates to reservoir oil and gas. The what the courts are seeking, and one of the justices alluded to it, is not a double recovery. Because theoretically, if you had a reservoir very productive and you drilled the first well, and no matter what collapses, if you don't have a finding that a reservoir has been permanently damaged with implied warranty, strict liability, you're going to get double recovery if you just lose loss of production because the reservoir is still there.
Isn't that just evidentiary, though?
Well, what does it become matter of law just because this man said it? Because they had a chance to secure it just because this attorney says that the reservoir is permanently damaged. You don't have any finding on that. Are you saying that just because this George Temple comes up and says it's permanently damaged, that becomes a matter of law? I don't think the cases require that. So you're sitting here with a finding that this reservoir is not permanently damaged. Now, if you look at the special issues. Now, let me address the indemnity and plea tax. I'm in the middle of this. A, ball from B, B ball from C, who me, and B ball from D. And so, Mr. Patterson, who worked with Mr. Nichols at that time, I got a stipulation that I didn't handle it in any way. Now, this court has said in Bonnewell, and you said that very, it's been filed in Duncan v. Sustin, and it's been filed in the Fifth Circuit by Kennan, about only vestige common law and damage remain. Now, I got a stipulation. If you look at that stipulation, it says, Mr. Crescent, if ATEX is ever held liable, you didn't handle this. It wasn't in your possession control. And that's what the court said in the Bonnewell about an innocent retailer chain of commerce. Now, there's a reason for that. And the reason for it, I want to address in the platex where it is true that this court said there is no right of indemnity against the defendant who is not liable to the plaintiff. It cites Hunter, cites Brown and Ruby. And if you look at those two cases, in Brown and Root, you had the exact situation here. The plaintiff would have sued ATEX, Crescent, and Mustang, and Crescent and Mustang got summary judgments. And so that's what the court said in Brown and Root. Now, I don't believe the court meant that. because litigation in this state is prevalent with the following fact situation. A plaintiff sued an automobile dealer on a contained apparatus, master cylinder, 1 year, 364 days after the lawsuit arose. And the defendant automobile, the plaintiff didn't have a cause of action against General Motors or Ford or Chrysler because the statute of limitation run. And all the indemnity work that my office seemed handling is the statute of limitation already run against the plaintiff. So I don't, and this court has granted indemnity on those situations because A, the plaintiff wouldn't have a cause of action as a dealer because statute of limitation run. But just because he doesn't like to sue him, that doesn't mean that B doesn't have an indemnity if he's in a retailer in a chain of commerce. And so I think that phrase, there's no right of indemnity, has to be looked at in connection to Hunter, which was a trust department and doesn't have anything to do with the present situation. And Brown and Root, which, as I said, before the court. Lastly, as Spencer pointed out, one of the justices, in connection with Mr. Nichols' argument about what burden Andrew got, what was found, there was an issue that had been pointed out, number six. It was defective when it was originally sold. Now, between the originally sold, the parties before the court were the plaintiff, Sesco, Atex, Crest, and Mustang. Now, it would have been a really duplicitous. I don't assume he's trying to say that number six, just going back down and get another species with number eight, just track that language and add to it when Mustang sold it. Well, between the parties, those are all free before the court, especially issue six, which we're entitled to that benefit when it's written sold because it's between the parties in this lawsuit, it's written sold by Mustang. And I certainly think through this stipulation, I bet my burden of proof, Bonniewell, Mr. Cessna, so far as I know, has certainly not been overruled. It bears a place in commercial enterprise because the innocent retailer can never get indemnity in a contained cater case. And this was a contained type of case, like was talked about in McKissick, one of the cases talked about, because although there were several ramifications about you could put tongs, you could lose, you could do this, do that. The finding says it was effective when it was originally sold. And therefore, we do not think Mustang. I think I'm entitled to indemnity. I've adopted Mr. Nichols' points. I was not sued like he wasn't sued. So if Mr. Nichols is right, it's supposed to stop with Atex, then Crescent is in the same position as Mustang. I thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Operating conditions didn't have anything to do with it. Well, there's how the jury found Mr. Beatty's pipe defective because he admitted it on the witness stand.
Page 184 of the record.
184. It's also in there. It'll be on both sides of 84 because I spent a good deal of time, Mr. Beatty, talking about his admission in his deposition, his admission at the trial, and trying to weasel out of the trial, Justice Hightower. So it's all through there. And he never backed off the fact that his pipe was defective. Mr. Nichols had you believe pipe's never identified. Pipe's J&L pipe.
You're equating a deficiency with a defective?
He used the word defect at another point. I just didn't take the time to hunt it out of here. But at another point, he uses the word defect.
Do you point that out in your brief?
Yes, sir.
Now that's over. Jury heard that. Court of Appeals tried to ride around it. Court of Appeals got to look at all these pages, and that's when they withdrew their opinion. That's why the Court of Appeals withdrew their opinion. Now, they talked to you about this metallurgist that examined the pipe, and he said that there was nothing wrong with the pipe.
Lone Star called an expert to the stand and criticized Mr. Sandfield. He said, I couldn't render those types of opinions that he'd rendered. Because all he did was take 6 square inches out of a 30-foot piece of pipe and test it. He doesn't know the well operating conditions. He doesn't know what the conditions were downhole. He didn't know anything else. And an expert called by one of the other defendants said, I couldn't do that, and I doubt that any professional engineer could do that. And now they argue to you that the pipe was tested and that the pipe was not defective. The jury heard all that. The Court of Appeals tried to write an opinion and say that I didn't prove a defect.
And faced with the evidence in the motion for rehearing blown up on these charts, they withdrew that opinion. So that's over. To make it even worse, here's the testimony of a man storing pipe at his pipe yard who testified that one time before Apex was supposed to ship my client's new pipe, and when they got it in, it was old pipe. So this is not the first time Apex told a fairy tale. And the jury heard all that. And the Court of Appeals heard all that. This was bad pipe.
Mr. Atkinson, before your time expires, let me ask you, please, if the correct measure of damages is loss of market value and loss of production is relevant to but not conclusive of the loss of value, why would an opposing party object to that evidence when it's offered? Wouldn't the opposing party be entitled to not object, let the evidence come in, expecting that at some point there's also going to be evidence that based upon this production, this is the loss in market value?
Justice Heck, if I had tried oil field cases all my life, and I read a petition and the only allegation of damage in it was loss of production, and if I sat and listened to an opening statement, there's a case on that that y'all decided some years ago, when if I sat and listened to an opening statement, and all the plaintiff's lawyer talked about in the opening statement was loss of production, and in those two times up to that point, he had never once mentioned value before and value after, and all he'd been talking about in his pleadings, all he talked about in his opening statement was loss of production, I believe I'm on notice that that's what he's going to submit to the jury. Reference was made to the, by the way, Justice Phillips, the rules are three of them, 67, 90, and 274 in conjunction with each other as waiver rules. Reference was made to McDonald's practice by Mr. Clark in his argument, and I have something to say about that. Section 5.18 of McDonald's is one of the commentators that says, that Justice Heck, in answer to your question, that you've got to object to the evidence when it comes in on an improper measure, even if you have previously filed a special exception to the pleading on that point and it has been overruled. Not only does McDonald say that, but in a Tyler court case, Republic Bankers Life versus McCool, 441 Southwest 2nd 314, they quoted that exact language. So the answer to your question is, yes, sir, the law in the state of Texas right now is that even if you have accepted to the pleading and have been overruled, you still got to object to the evidence. And in our case, we didn't need it.
Counsel, today, will you leave any one of your charts?
Yes.
Just any one chart.
Sir?
Will you leave any one of your charts?
Any one of them. Those are not completely exhausted. Those are just some that I use in court appeals for rehearing.
I understand. But any one will be fine.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'll attempt to be very brief. I must take issue with Mr. Clark's contentions. He acts as if his client Atex never touched the pipe. The pipe was picked up in Oklahoma City by a trucking company hired by Atex. Atex became responsible for that pipe the moment it was picked up by Turner Brothers Trucking Company. It was then trucked to Kilgore, unloaded, and put on pipe racks. But Mr. Clark would have you believe that Atex never touched the pipe. Now I do, and I must concede, there's been a lot said about the stipulation. Yes, we stipulated that we sold the pipe. We didn't stipulate we sold the pipe in a defective condition, which is what they would attempt to have you believe. I would concede that Mr. Smith is correct in that if his client never handled the pipe, which the record shows they did not, then certainly they could not have done anything to the pipe to damage it or cause it to be defective. And for that reason, that shows really how ridiculous the trial court's judgment really was when it directed the verdict. The trial court granted ATEX indemnity against Crescent that never handled a pipe and could not possibly have done anything to it. And of course, Mr. Smith stands up and says, well, Your Honor, if you're going to give them indemnity, I won't mind. Well, that's not the same situation, because as to me, they had to prove the defect, and they failed to do it. Because ATEX had handled the pipe, and many chances for it to have been mishandled took place. And you simply can't assume the defect as to my client. I do want to point out one further thing so there can be no question, and I direct the court's attention to special issue number 5. Do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that ATEX sold such joint of pipe in a defective condition? ATEX sold. And then special issue number 6, of course, is properly predicated upon an affirmative answer to 5, and that's where they say, do you find from a preponderance of the evidence that such defective pipe, if any, reached Cesco without substantial change in its condition from the time it was originally sold? And I think the literal reading of that, because there's never any inquiry in the charge at any point as to whether there was a defect in the pipe at the time it was sold by Mustang. So certainly I think this has to relate back to special issue number 5, which it does, and the inquiry and the way the jury understood and believed it was that the pipe was defective at the time ATEX sold it. Again, Your Honor, you know, we disagree with a lot of the things that happened. I don't think it was the proper measure of damages, but basically that's not our fight. The proof simply is totally failing as to us, and we believe that the court should render judgment that the indemnity not be granted to either Crescent or to ATEX.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.